Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Carefully think about whether they want to take the risk of giving another vaccine to their child.
A CDC panel votes to stop recommending that all newborns get a hepatitis B shot.
It's Friday, December 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the aftermath of an immigration surge in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Some parents kept their kids out of school at the height of the operation.
They had notes pinned on their backpack that says, I am a citizen. I would never think that that's something that I would see.
Plus, Spotify gives users a personalized recap of their year in music, including their so-called listening age.
It creates just another shot to the system for us to talk about. If you're 20 and your listening age is 70, what's that say about you?
Yeah, and should you share it? First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Supreme Court will weigh in on President Trump's bid to roll back automatic birthright citizenship for nearly everyone born on U.S. soil. Trump wants to limit it to those who have at least one parent who is a permanent resident or citizen. The man accused of planting two pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol the night before a mob of Trump supporters stormed the building nearly 5 years ago was in federal court today in Washington, D.C. This was Brian Cole Jr.'s first court appearance since his arrest yesterday. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
Brian Cole Jr. is charged with transporting an explosive device with intent to kill and with attempted malicious destruction with explosive materials. At his initial court appearance, Cole was dressed in a beige jumpsuit and glasses. He stared at the table in front of him as the magistrate judge read the charges against him, and Cole answered yes when asked if he understood. Prosecutors said Cole had spoken with law enforcement for more than 4 hours Thursday following his arrest, but they didn't provide any details in court on what he said. The judge set a detention hearing for later this month. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Advisors are recommending the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention do away with a blanket guidance to immunize all babies against hepatitis B within the first 24 hours of life. NPR's Rob Stein reports on why the advisory panel decided to re-examine the long-established vaccinations for infants.
This committee was put together by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has long questioned many vaccines and has launched a major review of all childhood vaccinations. Some members of this CDC committee argue that there's insufficient evidence that giving all newborns the vaccine when they're so young is really necessary, given that the hepatitis B vaccine is often spread through sex or drug use. They also question whether it's safe to immunize babies so early in life.
Rob Stein reporting. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the president does have the constitutional power to fire members of two independent agencies at will, despite federal laws to the contrary. More from NPR's Andrea Hsu.
In a 2-1 decision, the court ruled that President Trump's firings of National Labor Relations Board member Gwen Wilcox and Merit Systems Protection Board member Kathy Harris were lawful, despite federal laws that state they can only be fired for cause. The appeals court found that a 1935 Supreme Court decision limiting the president's power to remove officers at multi-member independent agencies like theirs doesn't apply here because both agencies wield substantial executive power. On Monday, the Supreme Court will hear arguments in a similar case. The Trump administration has asked the court to strike down that 1935 precedent and recognize that the president has unlimited power to remove those who assist him in carrying out his duties. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The Dow is up more than 100 points. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. New legislation unveiled in San Francisco this morning would provide over $5 billion in new federal funding for affordable housing and efforts to combat homelessness. California Senator Adam Schiff announced the bill on the roof of a brand new affordable housing project in the Dogpatch neighborhood alongside city officials. Here's Schiff.
We need to be building a lot more housing all throughout California. Housing that is affordable, housing that meets the needs of families, working families, middle-income housing, low-income housing. We need it all.
The bill, known as the Housing Boom Act, is part of a joint push by House and Senate Democrats to emphasize affordability. UC Berkeley is launching a first-of-its-kind initiative today to close the gap in medical research between male and female athletes. The Women's Health and Performance Initiative will use AI and data from UC Berkeley athletes to build health models specifically for women. Former UC President Janet Napolitano is leading the project. She says using male data for female bodies creates risks, not just on the field, but in national defense.
So as we improve health outcomes through this initiative for female athletes, we can apply lessons learned or new technology created or new tools developed to the health outcomes of women who have chosen to protect the nation.
Napolitano says less than 10% of sports medicine research now is focused exclusively on women. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters December 12th. Support for KQED comes from TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, presenting Georgiana and Kitty, Christmas at Pemberley. This holiday sequel to Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice performs through December 28th at Palo Alto's Lucy Stern Theater. Info at TheaterWorks.org. Time for All Things Considered on KQED News at 6 minutes after 1 o'clock.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In a historic vote, vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have stopped recommending that all babies get a dose of the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. The vote was contentious. It is strongly opposed by most of the medical community. NPR's Ping Huang has been watching. Hey, Ping.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so this is the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee. What prompted them to change the policy?
So earlier this year, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dismissed all the previous members from the panel, and he handpicked his own, many of whom, like Kennedy, have long questioned the safety of vaccines that have long been in use. Mm-hmm. So the hepatitis B vaccine is among the first vaccines they're reviewing on the schedule, and the committee cited concerns from some parents and also said that other comparable countries don't give hepatitis B vaccines so early. Here in the U.S., they've been recommended for all healthy newborns for over 30 years, and that policy is credited with dramatically reducing liver disease. Since the 90s, annual Hep B infections in infants and children have dropped by 99%.
And yet they've voted to stop all vaccinations?
To stop recommending it for every baby, so they're still recommending it for babies whose mothers test positive for hepatitis B. But the panel now says that other parents, whether they were negative or they didn't test, should talk with their doctor first before getting the vaccine. Now, some members who supported the change did it for parental choice. Here's Retzef Levy, a professor of operations management at MIT.
The intention behind this is that parents should carefully think about whether they want to take the risk of giving another vaccine to their child. And many of them might decide that they want to wait far more than 2 months, maybe years, and maybe up to adulthood.
But a CDC official pointed out that this has always been a recommendation and not a vaccine mandate. Still, Levy was one of 8 members who voted for the change. There were 3 members that opposed it. Pediatrician Cody Meissner from Dartmouth said it went against his oath as a doctor to do no harm.
Thoughtful inquiry is always commendable, but that inquiry should not be confused with baseless skepticism.
Many medical professionals also spoke against the vote at the meeting.
Okay, just to emphasize, this was a vote by the advisory committee. It's not binding, so what happens now?
Yeah, so now it's up to the CDC's acting director to decide whether to accept the guidance as policy, and that's a move that could take hours or weeks. We're not sure yet.
Got it. Hey, beyond the committee, beyond the CDC, how are folks you're speaking to responding?
So many in the medical and public health communities are very upset about the vote, and they're worried about its likely impacts on health. Now, that is even though with this change, the hepatitis B vaccine should still be covered for free for any parent who wants it for their child. But Dr. Sue Wong, a physician in New Jersey and a hepatitis B advocate, says it will sow chaos. Fewer babies will be vaccinated.
in years down the road, we are going to see that really nice decline we had with getting acute hepatitis B and chronic hep B cases down. We're going to see it go back up again, and we're going to see rises of liver cancer. And so this is really a travesty.
Those in public health also see it as part of a broader push by Secretary Kennedy to undermine vaccines and discourage people from getting them, even though the evidence in the safety record has not changed. There are signs of that in some of the other topics there.
Okay. Give me one or two sentences on what other topics were.
Yeah, sure. So the panel heard from Aaron Seary, who's a lawyer who's suing HHS. He questioned the safety of many common childhood vaccines and called for ending vaccine mandates. Mm-hmm. And they also questioned the safety of aluminum-based additives to vaccines that have been used for almost 100 years.
Okay. Thank you, Ping.
You're welcome.
And Pierce Ping Huang.
The Trump administration's aggressive immigration crackdown has arrived in New Orleans and Minneapolis as federal agents continue expanding their dragnet for undocumented immigrants. This follows a recent strike in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hundreds of Border Patrol officers descended on the city November 15th, arresting about 400 people in a week-long operation. The enforcement surge there appears to be over, but as NPR's Adrian Florido reports, Charlotte is still grappling with the fallout.
It's the end of the school day, and a yellow school bus pulls up outside an apartment complex in East Charlotte that is home mostly to immigrants. About 10 elementary school-aged children hop out. There are no parents to greet them, as there normally would be. The kids walk and run the rest of the way home alone. It's just one way that life looks different in Charlotte in the aftermath of the Border Patrol's operation here last month.
It's like a hurricane came through.
Stephanie Sneed is chair of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education.
We're still not quite sure if the storms are completely over. And then we have to deal with the aftermath, which is much longer than the event itself.
At the height of the operation last month, about 20% of the district's 141,000 students stayed home. Parents have started sending them back, but with precautions, Sneed says.
They had notes pinned on their backpack that says, "I am a citizen." I would never think that that's something that I would see.
The economic impact is also still visible everywhere. It's visible in the shuttered Mexican food truck owned by a woman who asked that we ID her by her first initial, E, because she's undocumented. E and her family were preparing meals in the food truck when, on November 14th, they saw on social media that a large Border Patrol convoy was driving toward Charlotte. They panicked.
Cuando nosotros vimos eso, en ese momento agarramos, cerramos la traila y dijimos no más.
We closed the truck and we said no more, E says. They rushed home and locked themselves in. The next morning, she watched on TV as federal agents started nabbing people off the streets and raiding construction sites. 3 weeks later, E still will not step outside her house. She doesn't believe the Border Patrol agents who swarmed the city are actually gone.
Pues ellos están esperando el momento que nosotros salgamos, para que ellos nos casen como los gatos, el gato y el ratón.
They're waiting for us to go outside again, she says, so they can hunt us like a cat hunts a mouse. Charlotte has been one of the nation's fastest growing cities for more than two decades, in part because it became a banking center. Tom Hanchett is a Charlotte historian.
In the 90s, Bank of America built the tallest building on our skyline, and the story is they hired a steel-setting crew from Texas. And there were a lot of Hispanic people and a lot of Mexican natives standing up there on that steel looking down going, well, it's a pretty nice place. It's got a booming economy, and maybe we could, you know, try to make it here.
And they did make it here. Today, about a fifth of Charlotte's population is foreign-born. Many Latino immigrants here work in construction, hospitality, and own small businesses. Manolo Betancur is one small business owner. He's from Colombia. He's owned a popular Latino bakery here for 28 years. I meet him on the now-empty sidewalks of Central Avenue, usually bustling with foot traffic.
This avenue is always packed. All the time, you know, go to the laundry, go to the grocery stores, come to the restaurants.
On the morning the Border Patrol arrived, he was walking to his bakery with his U.S. passport in his pocket when an SUV stopped half a block ahead of him. What he saw is seared in his mind. Agents jumped out, tackled three men who looked Latino, zip-tied their wrists, and hauled them away.
And I just turned around and I saw a lot of people that were coming this way.
Like walking this way,
families. Yeah, walking this way, families. So I just turned around and I told them, they're here, and just go back to your house, and everybody started running.
He called his employees and told them to lock the bakery doors. Later that day, he announced online that he was closing Manolo's bakery.
I don't want for people to tell their kids, I'm going to go to the bakery to get your birthday cake, and then that kid never going to get her father back or her mother back.
Casey Crimmins runs Project 658, which provides services to immigrants in Charlotte, including medical care. When he saw Manolo Betancourt on the news saying he was closing shop, his heart dropped.
When it's in Chicago, when it's in L.A., they're scrollable shorts. When it's Manolo, who I literally had just seen 4 days before, saying to a camera, I've never seen anything like this before. I have to shut down my shop. It just hits different.
He and others in the community sprung into action, alerting people about raids, helping kids get to school, delivering food to immigrants' homes. Crimmins says residents want to show that this is still a welcoming city, a reputation forged on hard-earned trust.
This brought a sense that all of that that was built up over decades got flushed down the toilet.
Yeah.
Two employees of a medical clinic his group oversees, Lindsay Velker and Mary Beth Stanford Picker, are out delivering medicine and food to an undocumented patient.
Estamos aquí afuera de su casa con sus medicamentos y la comida también.
The patient is an older woman from Honduras. Okay. She requested that we use only her first initial, R. The week Border Patrol was in town, she says, agents roaming her apartment complex knocked on her door two different times.
Como hay un hoyito, ahí se ve. Entonces yo vi que habían dos.
She recognized their beige uniforms through the peephole. She stayed quiet and they left, but she is still struggling to sleep. R cares for children while their parents are at work. Her income plummeted when people stopped bringing their kids. Today, she's only caring for two kids. She walks them to school, but she stopped using the sidewalk and started walking through the woods.
Un caminito, yo misma abrí con un machete el caminito. Unos ramos que habían irte.
She cut a path through the brush with a machete. They won't find me in there, she says, with a nervous laughter. Daniela Andrade is with the Carolina Migrant Network, an advocacy group. She says Charlotte won't be back to normal until people feel safe again.
Because it's very hard to say, oh, they're gone and let's live, go back to normal life. It's really hard to, right now in these moments of crisis and fear in our community, to tell folks to trust.
Instead, she and other advocates have been telling people not to let their guards down. Adrian Florido, NPR News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Just ahead on the program, NPR's history podcast, Throughline, examines the roots of Sudan's civil war. That is just ahead on the program on this Friday afternoon. Michael stayed in for Sandy Althaus. Good afternoon. At 118, support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. And Heath Ceramics. Heath's Make Good Market returns to San Francisco this weekend. Visitors can explore dozens of craft vendors along with food trucks from off the grid. Heath Ceramics, handcrafted in the Bay Area since 1948.
Hi, it's Layla Faldin from NPR. Earlier this year, I reported a special series for Morning Edition about free speech in the U.S., and I'll never forget what one leading scholar of the First Amendment told me. He said, free speech is the right from which all other rights flow. If we lose it, we lose the power to stand up for any of our other freedoms. Please stand up for free speech and a free press by giving to this station today.
Give at kqed.org/donate.
When you're playing a video game and you get knocked out, most of the time, if you wait a moment, you get another character, another chance, and sometimes real life is the same way. On the next Snap Judgment, respond. Storytelling with a beat. Do not listen.
Listen Saturday afternoon beginning at 1, followed at 2 tomorrow by Radiolab.
On the next Radiolab.
Out of like 6,000 some species of mammals, they thought we were the only ones.
The medical mystery.
We were just freaks.
Of menopause. That's on the next Radiolab.
Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the Subaru Share the Love event. It runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. Subaru. And support comes from the listeners like you of KQED News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Sudan has been at the center of a brutal war since April of 2023. It's the site of the world's largest hunger crisis. More than 4 million people have fled the country since war broke out, and the World Health Organization estimates at least 40,000 people have been killed. Rund Abdel Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei, co-hosts of NPR's history show Throughline, tell us the story of how things got so bad.
The roots of today's war in Sudan go back over a century, from British colonial rule to a cycle of revolutions and coups that started after Sudan gained independence in the 1950s. In 1989, that cycle turned once more. A man named Omar al-Bashir took control of Sudan in a coup, and as soon as he had power, he turned his attention to trying to keep it.
For decades, he ruled with an iron fist. The average Sudanese person suffered. The economy was poor, and people struggled to find food to eat.
The protests against Bashir started, unsurprisingly, in the periphery.
This is Khulood Khair. She's a Sudanese political analyst who runs a think tank called Confluence Advisory.
December 2018, a bunch of school children who were protesting that their sandwiches at school were too expensive.
The government's response was swift and harsh.
The government has been using live ammunition and tear gas to disperse the crowds.
And very quickly that caught the hearts and minds of many, many people.
The protests spread throughout the country. A mood of possibility was in the air.
Demonstrators who've been met with live bullets and tear gas say they want President Omar al-Bashir's nearly 30-year reign to end.
At the beginning, things were very rosy.
This is Ibrahim El-Badawi. He's a Sudanese economist.
And the army switched loyalty to the public, declared that it's actually going to support the revolution.
Hemeti and General Burhan, as the kind of two most powerful military figures in the country, worked together to kick Bashir out.
This is Christopher Townsell. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Washington, who focuses on the history of modern Sudan. Burhan was a top general in Bashir's armed forces. Hemeti commanded the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. And Christopher says that after Bashir fell, it seemed like both generals would do as they'd promised and cede their power to a new civilian government.
I arrived just one day earlier, before the massacre.
2 months after the triumphant moment of Bashir's fall, Ibrahim al-Badawi came to Khartoum. He was there to support protesters who were staging a sit-in outside the army's headquarters because the generals had not ceded power. They met the protesters with force.
We're being attacked by the Rapid Police Forces and the police.
There was a sense of despair, actually. And the whole country was just devastated.
The Khartoum massacre in June 2019. Hemeti's Rapid Support Forces opened fire on civilian protesters, killing more than 100. Many more were beaten, raped, and violently detained. And the military, led by Burhan, watched it all happen, right on its doorstep. This was the same military and the same RSF that had seemed so eager to support this democratic revolution a couple of months earlier, to help the starving and impoverished and turn Bashir's 30-year rule over to the people. But now, Burhan and Hemeti had turned on the people.
But then, shortly after, this triggered a massive outpouring of protest all over the country. And so eventually they were forced to negotiate with the leadership of the revolution.
Ethiopia and the African Union stepped in to help Sudan set up a transitional government that would eventually hand off to a civilian elected administration, finally bringing true democracy to Sudan. Both civilians and military officials were chosen to serve on the transition council. Burhan and Hemeti each had a seat at the table. It helped that the U.S. and other Western powers lifted sanctions on the country.
Opportunities were open to Sudan, big time. Debt relief, political openness, and so on.
At first, that seemed to work for Burhan and Hemeti.
But I do think, though, that they were reluctant partners.
Reluctant partners, who in hindsight, he says, had never actually committed to the idea that the military would hand power back to civilians.
Some Sudanese, they call it a creeping coup.
In 2021, with the country moving closer to the day when the military was supposed to hand control of the government off to civilians, Hemeti and Burhan decided their time had come.
Sudan was moving toward democracy, but then today the military arrested the transitional government's leaders and put the acting prime minister under house arrest.
Burhan took over control of the country, and both generals were amassing wealth and power. But even as they appeared to be working together, the two men were on a collision course, because there was one big thing they couldn't agree on.
And this was the future role of the rapid support forces.
The paramilitary force Hemeti still controlled.
Whether the rapid support forces would be incorporated sooner or later into the army. Burhan wanted it to be incorporated sooner, 2 years. Hemeti wanted it to be 10 years. It would obviously kind of protect him longer.
Neither Burhan nor Hemeti was willing to budge.
And that would put the country on a path to this tragic war.
What happens in April 2023 is the beginning of the trauma and the hellscape.
And then once the fighting broke out, it could never be stopped.
There's one more layer to this conflict, and it's the most tragic one. Khulod Kher says both generals, Burhan and Hemeti, actually share a common enemy in this war, the people of Sudan, and the dream of democracy many have held for decades.
It is a war against civilians. And so while they are fighting each other, they're also fighting the civilians of Sudan, who they recognize as the true change agents in the country. And what's interesting about Sudan's history, that has such a long history of armed conflict, there's always been non-violent action by a large proportion of different groups of Sudanese people that have brought down military dictatorships.
That was Sudanese political analyst Khulod Kher, Sudanese economist Ibrahim El-Badawi, and University of Washington professor Christopher Townsell. You can hear the full episode on the war in Sudan and more from Throughline hosts Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdel Fattah wherever you get your podcasts.
This is NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for healthcare. And Rising Team, creator of Super Manager AI, giving leaders at all levels a leadership personal trainer and coaching partner to help build essential skills, practice hard conversations, and strengthen team performance. Learn more at supermanager.ai.
China is at the cutting edge of technologies that reimagine transportation. Self-driving cars are only the beginning.
Local governments are very aggressive to promote new technology to serve the public here.
Get a look at the future of transportation from inside China. That is next time on The World.
Among the stories you'll hear beginning this afternoon at 2 on KQED News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, we're going to Philly,
where it does not take much to get locals fired up to debate which local establishment serves the best cheesesteaks.
If anybody know anything about cheesesteaks in Philly, it's about the bread. It's not about the steak and everything. It's about the bread.
That story and more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Excitement is building for the next FIFA World Cup being co-hosted by the U.S. next summer alongside Canada and Mexico. The U.S. men's soccer team will face Paraguay in the first round here in Southern California, while Argentina and Lionel Messi will play Algeria to open its World Cup title defense. During today's announcement at the Kennedy Center in Washington, President Trump suggested he could move cup matches away from some Democratic-led host cities due to security issues.
I will tell you, if they do have a problem, by the time we get there, we'll take care of that problem. We can solve that problem. I've proven that in D.C. and everywhere else we went, so we'll take care of that very easily.
FIFA also gave President Trump its first ever Peace Prize after the Republican president openly campaigned for the Nobel Peace Prize earlier this year, but didn't get it. The Trump administration is pledging support for European political parties that fight immigration. That sparked criticism from some mainstream European parties, as we hear from NPR's Lauren Freyer.
Germany's Foreign Minister Johann Wadepool dismissed this new White House document, telling reporters in Berlin that Europeans don't need advice on democracy from the Trump administration. In this document, the U.S. pledges to support what it calls patriotic parties that promote nationalism and fight immigration. It does not name any such parties, but those are the platforms of far-right parties, including Reform UK and the Alternative for Germany, which is classified as extremist by German intelligence services. The White House says it's necessary to support such parties to promote, quote, European greatness and prevent a future where, quote, certain NATO members will become majority non-European. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Stocks finished higher to end the trading week. On a positive note on Wall Street, this is NPR. The congressional redistricting fight for next year's midterm elections is over for Texas after the Supreme Court yesterday allowed the state to use its recently redrawn map. It could help Republicans keep control of Congress next year. NPR's Hansi Luong reports.
In California, a federal court is set to hold a hearing this month on whether to block a congressional map that could help Democrats pick up 5 more U.S. House seats. California voters approved that map to counter the new Texas map that President Trump pushed for to help Republicans win 5 additional House seats. Missouri's Republican-friendly map is facing lawsuits and a referendum effort. New maps may be coming in Florida, Indiana, New York, and Virginia. And another wave of congressional gerrymandering may be on its way depending on what and when the Supreme Court decides in a Louisiana case. During a rare second round of oral arguments for that case in October, the court's conservative majority appeared inclined to weaken the Voting Rights Act's long-standing protections against racial discrimination in redistricting. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
Well, Netflix appears to have won that bidding war to buy the studio and streaming business of Warner Brothers Discovery for $72 billion. The deal does not include Warner Discovery's cable network, such as CNN and TBS. Netflix beat out Paramount and Comcast, winning one of Hollywood's oldest studios. The deal still needs regulatory approval and would allow Netflix to produce more programs here in the U.S. with access to Warner's vast catalog of movies and TV shows. This is NPR.
Support for KQED on All Things Considered comes from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, launching the Community Lifeline Fund, a response to public policy shifts endangering low-income residents' access to essential services. Info about supporting the fund at svcf.org. And support comes from Genentech, the original biotech pioneer. forging life-altering scientific breakthroughs to help improve the lives of all patients. Learn more about Genentech's commitment to patients and society at gene.com/ourpromise. This week in our Bay Curious newsletter, a mystery from San Francisco's World's Fair in 1915. Who manufactured the gems that bedazzled the fair's Tower of Jewels? Read that story in our Bay Curious newsletter. Tomorrow's weather looks about the same as today, partly cloudy in the morning, then becoming sunny, some patchy, possibly dense fog in the morning. Saturday's highs in the 50s to the mid-60s. Support for NPR comes from EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And ARM. On the latest episode of Tech Unheard, ARM CEO and host Renee Haas talks to Jayshree Ullai, CEO of cloud networking company Arista Networks, about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing. And support comes from the listeners of KQED. All things considered time, now 1:36.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In a blockbuster Hollywood deal announced this morning, Netflix said it's buying the vast studios and streaming properties of Warner Brothers Discovery. CNN and other cable channels owned by Warner Brothers are not part of the deal, but this would create a global entertainment and streaming giant. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here with more. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, Netflix is already the world's leading streamer, so why does it want or really need to buy Warner Brothers?
Yeah, and let's underscore the fact this is a departure for Netflix, which has not been in the business of acquiring. It's been in the business of building or licensing content for itself. I think it's a signal Netflix wants to be the everything store, the Amazon of entertainment, right? That they are going to, they're already the world's leading streamer. They're already a dominant name in American streaming, and that they want to essentially blot out the landscape as others are trying to grapple with them. So they're putting together the Warner Brothers movie studio plus HBO, you know, one of the great brands, and HBO Max, whatever name it's going by on any given day, put that together with Netflix. They've promised to continue to release Warner Brothers movies theatrically in theaters, but it would give it huge control over entertainment content. Some of the iconic hits coming under the same umbrella, Game of Thrones franchise, Harry Potter from Warner Brothers, and Squid Game. You know, these are elements of huge things that keep people coming back again and again.
I mean, Discovery and Warner Brothers are some of the biggest names in the industry. How could this change the shape of Hollywood?
Well, it's allowing Netflix to have access to, you know, all the intellectual property of Warner Brothers as well as their future things, assuming this deal goes through. You know, if you think of other franchises, there's Looney Tunes, one of the totems of my youth, but also the DC superhero franchises, right? And Warner Brothers has, in some ways, surprisingly, had a lot of successful movies lately, but Hollywood has been sculpting itself around the challenge that Netflix has posed. So you saw Disney not too many years ago acquire most of Fox's entertainment holdings to bulk up and supersize. You've seen Comcast and Paramount thinking that they would have a strong chance. In Paramount's case, they thought they had the inside track to acquire Warner Brothers studios and streaming services so that they could elevate from being CBS and NBC and Paramount and Universal respectively, combine it with Warner Brothers and take on Netflix. Netflix is saying, no, we're going to supersize the supersizing. This is a behemoth, a colossus bestriding the world of entertainment should it comes to pass.
I mean, anytime two companies that are in the same businesses merge, there's a big if. There are these antitrust concerns. How hard do you think it'll be for Netflix to actually get this approved?
Well, so let's talk about this in two ways, one of which is the conventional notion of antitrust, and that is the amalgamation or the combining of too many things that are of a like kind in ways that can distort the market for other players in the market, distort the market for consumers. After all, people are already shelling out, you know, in the teens of dollars each month for Netflix and for those who also subscribe to HBO Max for that. What leverage would this provide Netflix to raise that cost? I think you're going to see the antitrust division of the U.S. Department of Justice, which is led by somebody who takes a keen interest in these matters, really give a hard look at, does this concentrate too much power in the industry in this way? And you're seeing state attorneys general have questions about that and become more, shall we say, aerobic and muscular in thinking about antitrust issues of late. And you're also likely to see that, to be honest, in Europe, in the European Union. Let's talk about Trump world. President Trump plays an outside role in all of this, even though conventionally presidents aren't supposed to weigh in on these kinds of decisions. Donald Trump made clear that he thought that the path should be eased for the Ellison family, that his father and son, Larry Ellison, co-founder of Oracle, one of the richest humans on the planet, one of a handful of the richest people on Earth, and David Ellison, his son, the head of Skydance, who engineered just this year the takeover of CBS's parent company and Paramount's parent company, now called Paramount Global, merged that with Skydance. He was thinking, we're going to take all of Warner Brothers Discovery, all of their studios, all of their content, all of their cable properties, pump up Paramount, we're going to take on this. They're going to try to challenge this in a variety of ways, they've signaled, and we're going to see how that goes. The question of what Trump wants matters these days. His Justice Department clearly takes its cues, so I think that's going to be a real second strain to that question.
And David, the one thing we haven't really touched on is those cable properties you mentioned. What happens to CNN and the other cable properties if this deal does go through?
So as Comcast did with its cable properties, these would be spun off, presumably so someone could purchase it. The people you'd think might be most interested might be the Ellisons. After all, they just acquired CBS and have been thinking about CBS News, might want to fold CNN in. But it is making these places vulnerable. It's not clear what their future holds.
NPR Media Correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Spotify Wrapped is here, offering users a personalized recap of their year in music. This time around, the streaming platform is also calculating their so-called listening age. As NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, it's not necessarily what you would expect.
This week, I found out I'm 70 years old. At least that's my listening age, according to Spotify. That's because I listen to a lot of 70s music, like Billy Joel's The Stranger, 21 times. Then I felt the stranger kick me right between the eyes. For the last decade, Spotify has ended every year with an interactive recap of each user's listening habits. It usually includes their top songs, artists, albums, genres, and listening time.
Spotify Wrap is, by and large, an identity project for its consumers.
That's Marcus Collins, a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business, and an R&B fan with a listening age of 40 and a love of Boys to Men. It's become the norm for listeners to share their Spotify stats on social media.
It's a way by which we're able to project our identity based upon our cultural consumption.
Your listening age offers another way to do that, especially if it's multiple decades off your actual age.
It creates just another shock to the system for us to talk about. If you're 20 and your listening age is 70, what's that say about you?
Spotify is relying on a concept called the reminiscence bump, which says adults feel most connected to music from their teen years. So it looks at which five-year window of music you listen to more than your peers and does the math as if you were a teenager during that era.
For instance, for me, I still always return back to 90s R&B and 90s hip-hop. It jettisons us back to a time when we were sort of figuring ourselves out.
Those calculations can yield some pretty dramatic results if the social media memes are any indication. Songwriter Gracie Abrams' listening age is 14, about half her actual age, while electropop artist Charlie XCX clocks in at 75. Colin says this kind of shock value works to Spotify's advantage.
Because we don't talk about the things that are just boring. We talk about the things that are unbelievable.
So is Spotify rage baiting us for free publicity, or is it giving us a helpful way to connect?
The truth of the matter, it's both of them at the same time.
Collins, like many of us, learned about Spotify Wrapped's release from social media, not paid advertisements.
Then I said, oh, I want to know what mine is so that I can engage in the discourse, not because I love Spotify so much, but because I want to participate in the social practices of my people.
And that's a tale as old as time. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Ganges River in India is a sacred place in Hindu traditions. People put their loved ones' ashes in its waters as a final rite. But what happens when a family can't make the trip to India? Rose Schnabel with WUFT tells the story from Florida.
Growing up in South Africa as an Indian woman during apartheid wasn't easy for Vasanthi Doshi. She was born in 1942. She found comfort in music and sang from a Boy Scout songbook. She especially loved a song about the Suwannee River by Stephen Foster.
Way down upon the Suwannee River.
This Bing Crosby rendition came out in her childhood.
Somehow we just all wanted that song first. Very sad song. But with the sadness comes this hope that things will be better.
Today, the original 1851 lyrics are viewed as racist. They depict an enslaved person nostalgic for their days on a plantation. But to Vasanthi, now 83, the song meant something else, the chance to be far away from apartheid's reach. She got that chance after she married in 1970 and eventually moved to Florida after visiting college friends there. One day, her husband, Paresh, entered an auction for a run-down motel in Old Town, Florida, and won. The rooms backed up to a river.
It was not very visible at that time, you know, because of the overgrown foliage and the trees and all that. But I stepped out to the dock. There were steps going down to see how it was laid out. And I said, wow, what a spot.
He kept the river a secret from his wife, Vasanthi, who was angry at his real estate purchase.
I told him, you cannot buy that property. And he said, you just have to come one time tomorrow.
So she did. And it was Paresh who led her to the river.
So he's in the front pulling me, and I didn't want to go. Went on. It took a while till I got to the end.
But then she saw it, the Suwannee River.
What God does for us, we have no idea.
A few years later, when Vasanthi's dad passed away, she invited a dozen Indian families over for a funeral ceremony on the river.
They were shocked that I was doing that. And then started calling me.
Their motel has now become a gathering place for families who can't travel to the Ganges for funerals. Vasudha Narayanan directs the study of Hindu traditions at the University of Florida. She says Hindus believe sprinkling a loved one's ashes in the Ganges liberates the soul from the body. And local rivers often become a substitute.
They know it's the Suwannee or the Mississippi. They do think it is infused with the sacrality of the mother of all rivers, which is the river Ganga from India.
Vasanthi has started calling the Suwannee River her Ganga. People come from over 100 miles for the funeral ceremony. Her daughter Sapna gives a demonstration.
So what we're doing right now is lighting the lamp to put the boat in the water in memory of anyone who's passed.
The paper boat carries flower petals to make the soul's journey sweeter. Sometimes families scatter ashes in the water too, which Florida law doesn't regulate. But today, Sapna just watches the boat drift away in the heart of rural Dixie County, down here upon the Suwannee River. For NPR News, I'm Rose Schnabel in Old Town, Florida.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
On the way next, it's been a banner year for sports teams in Indiana. Also, the fight over cheesesteaks. More ahead on All Things Considered, KQED News. 148 Michael State in for Sandy Althaus. Support for KQED comes from Fast Track. Starting January 1st, carpools must use a Fast Track Flex toll tag set to 3+ for the carpool discount on all bridges except the Golden Gate and Bay Bridge. Learn more at getfasttrack.org. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity. Imagine that.
Oh, look, another week of delayed economic data. And by the way, have I mentioned the Fed meets next week? We will talk things over next time on Marketplace.
And Marketplace comes your way this afternoon beginning at 4.
On the next California Report magazine, rescued audio recordings from a queer church in San Francisco that provided a refuge during the height of the AIDS crisis.
Each one is of infinite worth, whether that person is diseased or not. We have AIDS as a community, and God loves us.
I'm Sasha Coca. Join us later today on KQED or the California Report Magazine podcast.
Hear that at 4:30 and again 6:30 p.m. on KQED News.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on Political Breakdown, we'll be in San Jose, where some of the leading candidates for governor participated in a forum sponsored by the California State Association of Counties. Among those participating, billionaire climate activist Democrat Tom Steyer and Republican Steve Hilton, a former Fox News contributor. We'll dissect highlights of the forum as the field of candidates continues to grow. It's Political Breakdown on KQED News at 5:50 today and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. It has been a banner year for Indiana sports teams. All of the state's major league professional teams, as well as a few universities, have racked up impressive winning records. For fans, it is a thrilling time after some truly lackluster seasons. Team owners, coaches, and players say this year's success follows years of investment and development. Samantha Horton with member station WFYI reports.
For sports fans in Indiana, the excitement started early in the year when Notre Dame's Fighting Irish made it to the College Football National Championship. And in the spring, the Indiana Pacers were in the NBA Finals. In the fall, the Indiana Fever made it to the WNBA playoffs. Before each playoff game for the Pacers and Fever, volunteers set rally towels and t-shirts on thousands of arena seats. Fever General Manager Amber Cox says the enthusiasm of all those fans motivated the players.
You want to play for them. You want to continue to show up for them. So, you know, through the tough times, they've been there for us and have been really our fuel throughout this season.
The good news continued in October. The Associated Press ranked Purdue University men's basketball number one in its annual preseason poll. And now Indiana University football and the Indianapolis Colts are having winning seasons. That's energized fans like Tom Henshaw. Before a recent Colts game, he was grilling food and tailgating with friends and family at a new spot a few blocks from the stadium. Henshaw jokes it may be superstitious, but the group can't go back to their old spot because they don't want to make a change while the Colts are on a roll.
Yeah, you can see that it's come together finally this year. We don't normally get to see home wins.
And athletes are getting into the excitement too. Fever point guard Sydney Colson says she has a Colts jersey now. And at basketball games, athletes are showing up for each other.
It's cool to see like the sections where it's several players coming to support the Pacers or the Fever. And that's cool to see from a city that all the teams support one another.
Amy Matheny says for Indiana University, it's taken years of strategic building to assemble the winning Hoosiers football team.
Lots of discussions. Oh my gosh. You know, it isn't like we haven't wanted to be good in football. We have, but doing it and competing for it, you know, is very different.
Matheny is a lifelong Hoosier who's in the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. She says raising coaches' salaries and taking advantage of opportunities that can be offered to recruits have helped. And it's not just about Indiana teams. Indianapolis, a city that bills itself as a sports capital, has recently hosted several major sporting events, including the NBA and WNBA All-Star Games and the U.S. Olympic Trials for swimming and diving. The state is also home to the NCAA, three national governing bodies, and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Indiana Sports Corp President Patrick Talty says the goal is to make the state an international sports destination.
We unveiled last year our 2050 vision, which is the strategy for the next 25 years of the sports strategy. And we really believe that Indiana can be the global epicenter of sport.
And that's something Indiana sports fans say they already know. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Horton in Indianapolis.
Philadelphia is known as the city of brotherly love, but that love can be tested when it comes to sports rivalries, also when it comes to the ingredients that make a cheesesteak great. Recently, the Michelin Guide honored three cheesesteak joints in the city. Food critics pounced on the judges, but reporter Buffy Gorilla found nothing but love for the vibrant cheesesteak scene.
The following customers are ready for pickup.
The smell of meat and onions hangs in the air outside D'Alessandro's in Roxborough. It's a few minutes after 11 a.m., and D'Alessandro's just opened its windows for the day.
The best cheesesteaks in the city.
A bundled-up Dante Cunningham waits for his order.
The regular cheesesteak, mayonnaise, fried onions, ketchup, pickles, and mustard, standard.
At D'Alessandro's, the go-to cheese is sharp American. The meat, fresh-sliced ribeye. But Cunningham says it's not about the meat.
The bread is key. If anybody know anything about cheesesteaks in Philly, it's about the bread. It's not about the steak and everything. It's about the bread.
D'Alessandro's is one of three Philadelphia cheesesteak places that Michelin awarded a Bib Gourmand. If you haven't heard of the Bib Gourmand, you are not alone.
What's that?
I've not heard of it, but I think without a doubt they're worthy of that award.
Well, Jack McGonigal and Jake Carvalho, the Michelin Guide's Bib Gourmand highlights places that serve quality food at reasonable prices. New Jersey native Carvalho loves a cheesesteak. After driving 10 hours from North Carolina, he made a detour to get one laden with onions and peppers from his favorite spot, D'Alessandro's.
This is about my fourth time here, and I'm in love with it, man. Every time I come by Philly, I gotta make a stop here.
Angelo's in South Philly also made Michelin's list.
My dad used to swear by Angelo's, as a matter of fact, until he came here. Yeah. I made him come here one time. He was like, wow, this is actually a lot better. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. Angelo's still, it's great. It's great. No hate to Angelo's. It's a great spot. But, hey, everybody's got their own opinion, though, you know?
Del Rossi's in the Northern Liberties neighborhood received a Bib Gourmand, too. They make their seeded sourdough bread in-house, and the place smells amazing. Since I was going to be there, my neighbor asked me to grab her a cheesesteak. Kathy Cote grew up in the Philadelphia suburbs and has lived in the city for over 40 years. Cote proudly claims to be a bit of a cheesesteak aficionado and thinks the Michelin accolades for this food are overdue.
It's about time. I mean, if they're going to do a food overview in Philadelphia, you need to include cheesesteaks. I mean, this is our unique specialty.
Cote unwraps her still steaming sandwich.
I've never had any cheesesteak from Del Rossi. I thought I should try the real thing. It is extremely heavy.
After her first bite, she reaches for a napkin.
It's a mess. Oh, it's good. It's really good. The roll's really good. It's huge.
When deciding where to get your cheesesteak, there are some big questions to consider. Chopping the meat versus slicing, soft bread versus a more structured option. But as Nish Patel, owner of Del Rossi, sees it.
Everyone has their favorite and people battle it out in the comments all the time, which is great to see.
When it comes to cheesesteaks, some places even dare to ditch the meat for the vegetarians and vegans out there. So there really is something for everyone. For NPR News, I'm Buffy Gorilla in Philadelphia.
Breast cancer among men is rare, but it is real. Some studies suggest it's more common among veterans, and the Department of Veterans Affairs says it diagnoses about 100 cases a year. So why did the VA make it harder for affected male veterans to get care and benefits? We'll have reporting on Monday's show. If you're not by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, and now playing in theaters everywhere. The Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org. And support comes from the listeners like you of KQED News. The world's on the way next. News updates, too, including a local news update about the new football coach for the Cal Bears men's team. More ahead. 1:59, Michael stayed in for Sandy Althaus with a crash in the North Bay. Here is Steve Herrera.
Hi there, Michael. Lots of brake lights in Novato. Eastbound 37 at the Lakeview Highway. A big rig jackknifed on its side. The vehicles are partially in the lanes, but traffic can squeeze by. Be careful. Fremont, northbound 680 before Mission Boulevard South. There's a couch in a middle lane. And in Livermore, eastbound 580 at 1st Street, a two-vehicle wreck impacting the right lane. Steve Herrera, 4KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. This holiday season, drivers picking up or dropping off loved ones using the Kiss and Fly area, they can avoid congestion at the terminals, making spirits even brighter. FlySFO.com/KissAndFly.